Hey, good morning. The House Education meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, February 20, 2012. The time is 8:03. Present are Representative Feige, Representative Peggy Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Representative Alan Dick, and others are on their way. We do have a quorum, and remind everybody to turn cell phones off. First order of business today is a presentation by Superintendent Duncan Ware of the Delta Greeley School District. And Superintendent Ware, thank you for joining us. Can you hear us, Duncan?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay. Committee aide Nick Kreitzel will move us through your PowerPoint presentation. When you're ready, introduce yourself for the record as you begin your testimony, and Representative Seaton is also here. Go ahead, Duncan.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Dick. House Education Committee, Representative appointed you to be as well. My name is Blair, Superintendent of the Delta School District. Presentation, just a quick overview of the district and some of the unique things that are...
Duncan, we're having a hard time to hear you.
Let's start first. Board of Education, seven-member board, with a significant number of
briefings. Duncan, try one more time, and if that doesn't work, we'll have you call in. Good morning.
Just real quick, secondary superintendent of the Delta Greeley School District.
Brief at ease. Duncan, time out. Do we call him or he calls us? Okay, Duncan, please call in if you would, and we'll have to go with audio conference, but... Committee, come back to order. Good morning, Duncan Ware. Go ahead with your presentation, sir. And Annette has your, I think she has your first slide up. Go ahead, sir.
Let me introduce myself for the record. This is Duncan Ware, Superintendent of the Delta Greeley School District. Good morning, House Chairman Dick, representatives on the House Education Committee. Next slide, please.
Go ahead.
Yes, our Board of Education is comprised of seven members representing a variety of constituents and stakeholders with our district. Not particularly unique to our district is a student representative and military representative who take an active role in an advisory position within our school district. Next slide, please.
Duncan, just go ahead, and that's right, she'll stay right with you.
All right. The Delta Greeley School District is comprised of seven schools. Of those schools, five of those are traditional brick-and-mortar schools, while we have a Delta Home School, as well as a Delta Cyber School. Next slide, please. Demographics, total enrollment of 919 students. You can see the various breakdown within those schools and particular grade structures. Next slide, please. One of the unique things about Delta Greeley School District is that our current ethnicity within the school district, in particular our Hispanic student population, is increasing with the active recruitment by the Alaska National Guard for the Missile Defense out in Fort Greeley. With a large, well, a proportionate number of students coming in who have a Hispanic background. We have a particular, next slide please, we have a particular interest in early learning with the pre-K program for special needs students, utilizing typical peers, an all-day kindergarten program, and an emphasis on early literacy skills. Next slide please. Instructional supports in place for the Delta Greeley School District. We actively participate in the MAP testing program, which is measuring academic progress, conducted three times a year, first of the year, mid-year, and in the spring of the year, analyzed to affect instruction in real time. Our teachers are avid data people, so being able to take some real-time data to affect instruction is very important to the success of our students. We also have IPAS Math, which is math intervention. It identifies skills that students need to develop, and it works methodically through those skills as an opportunity for catching up on some lacking skills development. In the past year, in fact today, is the conclusion of a year-long emphasis on the writing process with six traits writing and cross-curricular writing, including in the writing process not just regular classroom teachers, but also art teachers, physical education teachers, so that students have an opportunity to write in a variety of areas. We're undertaking a substantial curriculum mapping process where we are looking at Alaska standards, mapping those out, looking for additional resources as a way to identify a set of priorities in the direction that we're headed. Also use considerable amount of Title I funding monies for remedial reading and writing for those students who need the additional assistance. And not listed on the slide is the Student Attendance Review Board. As we call it, SARB, is an interagency committee that will work with parents and students to help increase their attendance in school. Next slide, please. Special areas of instruction. As a result of the additional funding in the vocational technical area, we've been able to beef up some of our offerings in the VOTEC area. As you can see, we provide instruction in everything from welding to AutoCAD, robotics, a distance learning course in Bush Physics. We have a radio station, KDHS 95.5, and also an accounting program. Next slide, please. Student activities play an important role in the education of students in the Delta Gridley School District. We have a unique program, a unicycle program. Maybe some of you have seen them. They've performed at the AESB State Conference for the Harlem Globetrotters halftime show in Fairbanks. Unique program involves a lot of our students. Athletics, our high school athletic program. Our students participate not just in athletics but a variety of other events. To an estimation of approximately 90% of our students are involved in some type of extracurricular activity. As you can see, a large variety of activities for students to extend their learning beyond the classroom. Next slide, please. Community connections. An important partnership for us is Partners for Progress Delta. It is a partnership with University of Alaska Fairbanks, Fairbanks Community and Technical College, Alaska Works, and Alaska Department of Labor. Out of that particular program, students have the opportunity to participate in the heavy equipment academy in the summers, construction trades academies, as well as certified nursing assistant courses, and they can also take courses in English and mathematics in preparation for their post-secondary education. Also, our partnership with Fort Greely Missile Defense. They have a new bowling facility that they've been generous enough to make available to our students so we can incorporate as part of our physical education program. And also, swimming lessons, which is, I believe, in Alaska very important because often many of the activities that our children undertake are in or about water. Have a partnership with Boeing, one of the contractors out of Fort Greely, Rocketry Club in our 4-8 school, Fort Greely, and also engineers coming into the classrooms. Reiterating that what you do with the model rocket, the same principles apply to the rockets that they work on. Delta Chamber of Commerce, we're an active member, participate fully. Youth Hockey Association, as well as the Delta Community Library. Next slide, please. Some special projects in the Delta Gridley School District. We're in the process of wrapping up a weatherization project at Delta High School, including a retrofit of new windows and doors, new boilers, heating system upgrades, and additional insulation. In the last year, coming online in October of 2011, is a biomass boiler for the high school complex. Fuel savings currently, if we're comparing our wood chip price and consumption to our heating oil expenses in the past, approximate savings of 66%. There is some additional electric consumption with the additional pumps and operations of the plant. So as we move through the balance of the year, we'll be able to get a better handle on exactly how much of that increase is attributed to the new boiler. I'd like to say thank you, and I will talk about results from our House District 6 iPads for Literacy. I've got Chairman Dick. It's much appreciated. I believe that that is an opportunity that opens some doors, not only for students, but teachers as well, to look at ways for improving student literacy. Additional projects at the high school with the balance of our funding. Our intent is to bring the high school into a better position to serve as community emergency shelter. Outside of Fort Greeley, the largest available space that if there was an emergency within the community to shelter people would be our high school. Also to improve our instructional space usage, upgrade our kitchen facilities, an emergency generator, and improve our science room complex with the shared lab, and also the creation of a fine arts classroom. Next slide, please. This is the result of the House District 6 iPad Literacy Project. You can see some pretty phenomenal results there. The blue indicating the pre-test information, the red being the post-test information, and the line progressing on an upward slope from the lower left to the right would be the expected normal growth. This was in reading literacy as well as math literacy, and teachers report that the students are rapidly engaged in the literacy project, and in fact having a student in one of the classes that participated, we have to do it at home as well. So that's great. Next slide, please. Next slide, it shows the results for the iPad Literacy Project for third grade. While the results are not as dramatic, we can see that there are some significant increases through the project and the implementation of the project. Of course, there are also a couple of students that are indicated that showed declines, and as the data is further processed, I believe that we'll look at integrity of implementation and other things that may be an explanation for those results. Next slide, please. Next slide is a three-year look at our proficient and advanced scores in language arts, mathematics, as well as our graduation rate. As you can see, we're fairly consistent and moving forward, and particularly mathematics at Delta Elementary School, proficient and advanced with a 9% increase from 2010 to 2011. Notably, Delta High School graduation rate, wanted to point out the 79% graduation rate in 2011. But the 82% that's indicated in the parentheses is if you take into account a five-year cohort for those students who are needing an additional year of to meet the graduation requirements. Delta Cyber School is a statewide program that offers online education. We have a service center in Anchorage. We serve a large number of at-risk students. Typically, when students register with us, particularly in Anchorage, to gather their records and information, it will oftentimes involve looking at four or five schools and their associated graduation rate. Our New Horizons High School is an alternative high school program. It's contained within our high school building, and it's small group, individualized instruction with a highly qualified teacher. Next slide, please. And that concludes my presentation this morning. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those at this time.
Can you go back one slide?
Yeah, Representative Seaton.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your second to the last, or your last slide before the question slide.
Yes.
The New Horizons High School, now are those students, then they're not counted in the Delta High School graduation rate criteria because
they're counted. Excuse me, Representative Seaton, through the chair. They are a school of themselves. They are not included in the high school graduation rates.
Okay, and yeah, Duncan, I also had a question in regard to testing. We know that there's so many distractions for instruction, you know, besides the holidays and parent-teacher conferences. And one of the conversations we've had here is about testing. If all the testing you did was MAP testing, would that provide you with enough information that you could do good instruction? Or do we need some or all of the other tests?
I believe the MAP testing would provide us with the information we need to make immediate decisions concerning student achievement. One of the difficulties we have is that with our current SBA testing occurring in April of each year, the results returned in May, we're through the year before we actually see those test results. And so anything put in place to affect that student achievement or that in response to those results is taking place the next year. And that's further compounded by the summer break, where you will typically you will have some loss, and so you do a lot of review within the first of the year of previously learned skills. MAP testing allows us to make those changes almost on an instantaneous basis.
Yeah, thank you. That is a conversation we've had down here. And one of the questions that I saw you had the Bush Physics course. Is that the course taught by Dr. Dan Soli out of the university, or do you have your own?
No, it's through the university.
So that's Dr. Dan Soli?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Duncan, when you guys, when your teachers set up for parent-teacher conferences, when are those normally conducted, in the evening or during the day?
We do it a variety of ways. In fact, our elementary school will hold both morning and evening. The high school tends to target their parent-teacher conferences, those students that are at risk. And our Fort Greeley school, because there are sometimes access and it's outside of town, it's not far, it's about 10 miles, but they will hold day conferences at the school, and then they will come into the elementary school and hold conferences in their cafeteria so that local people who may have difficulties getting out to Fort Greeley can accomplish their conferences in the evening time.
Do you typically basically shut down the school for the days of those parent-teacher conferences?
We do.
Okay.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, you know, the military families, because they travel and the children go from one school to another school, do you find that, do they need remedial schooling when they get there, or are they pretty much up to par? Do you find that their abilities different than the abilities of the kids that live around there?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. What we find is those typically those students are where they need to be. There may be instances that if a student comes in with some already identified special needs, that we need to work on those. What we find, particularly with our families who move into Fort Greeley, is they have an opportunity to stay for an extended time. We will have families who are here for 4, maybe even 5 years. So our ability to work with them and address any of their needs is far different than it might be at some of the other military installations in Alaska, where they cycle through fairly quickly.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your your iPads, are those checked out basically to a student for the year, and also if that device is going to follow that student through their career, can they check those out over the summer so that learning continues through that time, or is it are they warehoused at the school?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. Currently, we do not have iPads. We're not a one-to-one proposition here at this point. What we do have is that we have a number of mobile carts, and those iPads are very readily available. But no, they do not typically go home.
Okay, well, Superintendent Ware, thank you. Good presentation. Yeah, we'll work on that Skype or whatever that is down the road. We're in a learning mode here, but it certainly does help for us to get a visual on who it is we're talking to. So thank you, sir. Excellent presentation. Okay. We'll next take up HB 242, Public School Funding Digital Learning. Representative Wilson, how do you want to proceed?
I'll go forward at for a little bit, and then I'll come back up here.
Just for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Representative Peggy Wilson, District 2. House Bill number 242 establishes a digital learning funding factor into law to assist school districts in implementing a full range of digital technology. The bill proposes to multiply the average daily membership, again, by 1.005 to create a new digital learning factor. The new factor should provide about $6 million per year to spread across the state. Funds can be used to acquire a range of technologies such as mobile devices, tablets, notebooks, or smart boards, plus software and services like professional development and technical support. School districts will have complete flexibility to use the funds based on local needs. We have heard a lot of rhetoric around the building about education and how there is resistance to just increasing the student-based allocation. This bill provides the direct methods of change that will improve our educational outcomes. The digital learning program has been proven with the leveling the playing field pilot program. I think it fits the goal of spending funds to get measurable improvements in outcomes. I have been asked by the Association of Alaska School Boards. They have a group, Consortium for Digital Learning, the implementers of the pilot, to introduce this legislation. I believe the digital learning program could be one of the best tools we need to engage our students and to keep them in the classroom. There are Consortium for Digital Learning members in the audience present, and they will be able to answer your questions relating to this program much better than I can. So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I ask that they come forward and answer the program, the questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Carl Rose, and you're going to be joined by Bob Wickert. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. I'm also here with Bob Wicker. He's the Director for the Consortium for Digital Learning. I'll just make a couple brief comments, and then I'm going to turn this over to Bob. He's the technician. When we talk about transforming, and I don't know if you have this document on your Transforming Alaska. Okay. If you take a look at that top bar, we started in 2006. We started in 2006 with the one-to-one effort. If you follow that tracking, in 2006, the iTouch and the iPhone came online in about 2007, 2008. The iPad came online in about 2010. Back in 2006, we had no idea what was coming our way. I think that's an example of what we can expect in future years. Change is going to come very rapidly. We knew this when we first talked to this group about the world is flat. We talked about what the impact would be. We didn't think it would come this fast. I will share with you just briefly. When we talk about the infrastructure that's going to be required, the sponsor's testimony talked about all of the components, including professional development and technical training or technical support. Those are critical elements to ensure that your networks work. So what we've done now, from 2006, when we were trying to develop curriculum and program for one-to-one learning, we've moved to iPads that use applications. We've gone from curriculum to development to apps. People have actually developed this, put it online, And at the association, we have the iTunes U consortium, which is the repository for content. So we've moved very rapidly in a very short period of time, and I'm pleased to say that the private sector is moving as well in terms of connectivity. We're not there yet, but we are growing as connectivity is available. So the overall infrastructural support that we provide to school districts is just to ensure that we can get them up and running and that we can assist them in ensuring that they're doing it effectively. So I would just share with you one last thing. When we had an evaluation done of the 2006-2007 effort, we had, it was about 2010, I guess, Dr. Jason Oler from the university did an overall review for us. And on the end of the review, he put down some of the things that would be important to continue on. One would be, how do we replenish and how do we refresh? And one of the key areas that he talked about is, how do you sustain this effort? And I think that's the impetus behind this bill. We were trying to look to be able to get money into the system so that districts can make some choices and can have some money, seed money anyway, for technology. I think with that, I'm going to pass this over to Bob, and he's going to give you a report on House District 6 efforts and some other things. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Dick and the members of the committee here. I think this bill just before...
Identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Bob. My name is Bob Wicker. I'm the director of the Consortium for Digital Learning. This bill, I think, is very exciting because it does some things that we know that are needed. As Carl mentioned, we had a project review done of all of our programs, which are on the back of this page here. Kind of lists all the schools that have been involved in that from 2006 to 2008, and now finally our iPad project in House District 6. And one main concern that came out of that is how can schools sustain this effort over time? So we see this doing three things, actually. One, it enables new projects to start up. We have school districts out there who are ready to go, but they just have trouble finding the money for it. Two, it's going to be able to expand projects that are out there already. And Duncan did a nice job of talking about his project there. We have several districts within that HD6 project that are ready to expand, and they're searching for ways to do that. And then three, the projects that you see listed there are in need of refreshing and moving on also. So those three things are very important to have sustainable funding that people can count on. I came to CDL about a year ago. I was lucky enough to give you a little demo on some iPads last year. Since that time, the Consortium for Digital Learning has really changed into a service organization where we have we help school districts with aggregate ordering. So school districts, smaller school districts, sometimes larger ones, dump their orders into one site that we built, and then we deal with vendors and we go out and get the best price that we can. We've put about $2.8 million worth of orders through that site since last spring, and districts have been able to get some discounts that they don't usually get. We've also been working with some entities to develop some professional development that's more broad-reaching than just vendors can put out. You know, people who sell smart boards do smart boards. People who sell iPads do iPads, and we're trying to help them to come up with different ways to train teachers who want to use a smart board and an iPad and Google Docs and do it all together. So we've been working with some entities to do that. And also done a lot of leadership training of our own. And Then the next thing that Carl answered was, or talked about was iTunes U. The other thing that's needed for these projects is digital content, and we're working very hard to develop a library of courses and units along Alaskan-based themes so that teachers can grab that content and get it onto their iPads and move forward with that. All of those things come out of research and things we've learned about these projects that support structure needs to be there. And this money within HB 242 can help to provide those critical components. Other thing we do are projects. And we've had a really nice project going, and that's what you have in this document, the HD6. Through the generosity of Representative Dick, we have 9 school districts in this project. We targeted third grade, and then the grades surrounding third grade. We thought it was going to be easy, right? Third, fourth grade. Well, all the schools, they don't have straight third grade. So in some schools, it was grade 2-3, and others 3-5, and others K-5. And so with third grade as the center, 9 of the districts got projects for this, which included an iPad per child for that grade level, charging stations, apps, covers, all of that kind of stuff that we put together for them. And then they were also required to put in a district match, and that district match equaled the professional development and the technical support piece. So it was a pretty targeted implementation, very aggressive timelines. School districts were very cooperative, some having to change their calendars for their teacher professional development and testing. We really wanted to make sure we had a pretty good handle on what was going on there, so testing had to be done before the iPads were handed out. We used Dibbles and Ames Web, which is a fluency test, for the pretest, and then again right before the semester break. Some of that data is still coming in. So it was just fortunate that Duncan would talk today about this, because that his school is the one that's in the pamphlet before you. I think the graph, though, I think that's the most significant in this little piece here, is this graph right here, the one with the two bars. And it's about teachers changing their instruction. Have the iPads changed your instruction? And overwhelmingly, I think it's yes. And that with technology, you might have this document here, too. It talks about change, and that we're in a place of change right now, where all the efforts that you see with these projects are starting to move into this yellow area of change. We're seeing teachers adopt that change and want to adopt that change. That's a big deal. And I think this move by HB 242 will be one that helps that to not only stay in that adoption phase for those teachers who are there, but also help to move others that are wanting to get there. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I think we forgot to introduce the bill. The bill is fairly simple. The highlighted portions that are underlined are the changes, and in line 8 on page 2 is the factor of 1.005. Fiscal note on that would be about 5.9 million spread out over the state. It won't be a lot of money, but it will be some seed money. And I will share with you the thing that we learned in 2006. When districts have skin in the game, they pay close attention to what they're doing. I think the three options we're going to have to be able to talk about sustainability is going to be general fund, money that comes to us through the foundation. It's going to be through grant processes that we get, and possibly a program like this. And lastly, it's going to be through capital, through capital budgets. What Representative Dick has done here is a model for any legislator who wants to put a little bit of money into their schools. That's how this thing works. So you have three options. They're all going to use general fund. Whatever comes to them won't be enough to cover the whole template that they want. I guarantee you that. Nobody's going to give you enough money to do everything. So it's going to have to come from general fund. This is one way of creating seed money to create the opportunity and impetus behind investment.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Seaton.
thank you. So I was interested in that the ratio that you said was 1-to-1 for those grade levels, and yet we heard from the district that those are left in the classroom. And I believe that some of the real gains that were determined in Canby, Oregon, and the presentations we had from there was that, of course, many of those were the iPod touches instead of iPads, a little cheaper device, but the kids would take those home. They were practicing and playing their educational games on the bus to and for. They extended their educational day, and then they also had splitters that they finally had to get five splitters with earphones for, because the whole family and other siblings wanted to play those educational games and do those apps. So I guess it seems to me that if we've got a 1-to-1 in these classrooms and yet we're restricting it to classroom hours, we've lost potentially one of the biggest gains we can have from these, and that's extending the day through, you know, optional use by kids of educational materials. And so would you address that, and has the consortium taken any efforts or making any comparison? Are there some of the schools that are having those devices checked out so that kids do improve the length of time they're working on education in the day versus those that keep them in the school?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, your thought pattern is my thought pattern, and it actually goes down. We get back to the research about this, and really, some of the gains that we're seeing is just time on task, of having kids do the things that you would like them to do more. Okay, that's some of it. Our laptop program since 2006 have been one where the take-home policy has been strongly encouraged. And each district has to deal with that on their own, and each district has their own policies of whether that happens or not. There are several districts around the state, well, more than several, that have this take-home policy on their laptops. This project was like I said, very aggressive with its timeline, and while we were putting policies in place. Those things that happen with technology are usually centered around the policy. You can see that in schools all the time. When you go, and you may have experienced this, when you go into a school and you want to log on to their internet, a lot of times you're blocked, right, because of those policies. Those take some time to kind of get around, and I think that this one, this graph here around the adoption of change is a really important graph in that those schools, I mean, this is a new thing for a lot of people. So rather than go into it with everything wide open and then trying to clamp it down, some of them are going the opposite direction. Let's keep it tight, and then we'll let off as it happens. We strongly encourage that those iPads go home. That's one of the things that I'm thinking is going to kind of work its way through this spring as people feel more comfortable of them. And, you know, remember, they've only been around about a year and a half. So the iPad has. So we're still kind of seeing what's going to happen with that as far as the batteries and glass and damage and that kind of thing. So
hopefully
that answers your question.
Follow up?
Yeah, I guess... you know, one of the concerns that many people had was if they go home, how many are going to get broken and all. And I think it was instructive that Canby, Oregon, at the Associated School Board presentation, they had of all the, I think it was several thousand devices that they had, and they checked out, they had one that had a switch break, and that was it. They hadn't lost, or, I mean, the kids were extremely responsible and protective of their own device because it was checked out to them. And also, I think that people should understand the difference between the computers and the where you're using apps. You're not required to be on the internet. I mean, you have an app right there. It's all internal. You're playing, you're doing whatever that curriculum is, or playing that educational game with numbers or words, and it gets us around the much of the internet. The roadblock that we have in many places around the state, and it also gets us around the problem of having parents unsure that what their kids are going to be doing on the internet because the apps are on the device. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope we can get some more information from them later.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Bob. I'm going to refer to this. Is this yours, ASB? Okay. The question on the back, in the very back, it talks about the number of users, and it goes to Fairbanks, 96 users. You know, just a comparison, Delta Greeley has 87. We just heard from them today. Is this just for the your ASB?
Yes.
So this is, okay, so this
through the chat.
Just seemed like a small number of folks in Fairbanks involved. I had a question. Or just a question and then a comment. I think the mention of this, that some school districts really do need seed money, I think I agree with that. One of the comments I just had on this bill and tying it to the ADM, tying it to the student count, is that, I mean, obviously there's school districts that need a lot more seed money than others. Fairbanks went wireless, and we focused on that when I was a kid in the early 90s. And so it was really, so we've got a pretty advanced system compared to, you know, any of these rural school districts that are just, I mean, we just had a problem with Delta Greeley School District hooking in with their Skype network, probably because of their bandwidth. So how do you make sure that there's equity amongst those school districts to make sure that those school districts that really need more seed money, essentially, get the sort of seed money? I mean, it's more of a policy question. But
I'll take a shot at that. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. What we have is we have 53 school districts. All of them are governed by their local boards, and they have policies that they employ. If I could go back to Fairbanks, the reason that number is so small is that Fairbanks chose to first engage their teaching staff before students, and that's why the number was smaller. In other places, they have chosen to different means of going in and implementing. In some of our smaller school districts, they have had, because they're small, and because you can, with the use of alternative modes such as satellite and microwave signals, they've been able to use this. It's difficult, you know, it's difficult, but they have been able to advance. And because they're small, they can turn on a dime, they're flexible. Big school districts have a little tougher time because the more kids you have, the tougher it is to provide the program in terms of individual need. So when you ask a question about, I mean, it really is a policy question. You got 53 school districts out there who have limited resources, and how they want to employ those resources come into it when they develop their policy. And so when we go back to this, I believe you mentioned, and I don't want to get into deep here, but I believe you mentioned money is coming to school districts as part of the ADM. This section here is part of the block grant. So it'll be 1.005 from the block grant. So it'll be 20% plus 1% for the voc ed that you put in last year, plus 1.005 for technology.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, in what way is this being worked so that it actually is working with rural Alaska and helping get it localized, because one of the absolutely wonderful things about the internet is that everybody's welcome to it, really. And having culture and local knowledge be really an intimate part of this. What's being done on that?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I think we've seen in different areas of the state, we've actually seen some revival of some cultural activities. We have stories of students with their laptops taking the cameras, their cameras that are built in, and recording conferences and dance groups and things like that. We have stories of students doing oral histories of their elders. I have a meeting this afternoon with an outfit that does talking books, mm-hmm. and we're talking about the native languages of our state and how that might fit into this picture. So there's all kinds of ways to do this, and like you say, it's kind of an open door, and it's really who will step through that open door. CDL has been one where we've been able to bring people together so that we've got kind of a common infrastructure that helps to bring different projects to light. So let's say this language project that we're going to be talking about this afternoon, that comes about through a native corporation, and then we're helping them to align to this software company, that kind of thing. Hopefully that answers.
Oh, and excuse me, we do have two male voices here, so please identify yourself each time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Yeah.
Follow up?
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. What you're saying sounds really good. I have seen some really fabulous things have been done by students doing filming of their community and interviews of their elders, that kind of thing. But what you know is that there are always incentives and disincentives, and that if we build things in, then it makes it opens the door. I mean, it's a door that can be opened, but unless there's incentives, it makes it a little tougher, and especially when it's the most modern part of what we're bringing to the schools. And I guess what I'd like to know is, do the different school districts themselves and the different school boards wind up being any part of this? Because many times they're the ones who are really representing their community. And is there any effort to share between rural communities, for instance, kind of in a mentoring way, how to expand this kind of thing?
Through the chair, Carl Rose, you ask a very broad question, and I will share with you this. There's so much diversity in our state. We have school districts that are very small, mm-hmm. with limited capacity, some that are very large. Through the association, we have an opportunity to coalesce at our meetings, at our in-services, at our academies. We have two academies, one in the winter, one in the fall. We bring technology and information to them to heighten the awareness. In every one of our school districts, they're just not grant-generated when they get into technology. They have to find the money from general fund to invest. So the availability of resources, the local need, plays a part in it in terms of the policy that they will employ. We do share our successes. In fact, when you look at HB6, here's something that we missed. We didn't get our money last year to do this thing until July. Schools were out. We couldn't provide the professional development until early fall. And in a short period of time, about 3 months, those results, 3 months were the results that you saw there, because it took us time to put everything together. I will share with you House District 6, some of those sites are rural. And maybe you would think lack the capacity, but we're successful and are successful and are growing. So it's just a matter of local school districts finding the resource, taking a look at what's going on around the state. As you look at our academies and our conference and our offerings, and decide what it is that they want to do. They almost always contact us for assistance in technical assistance and professional development and now purchasing. So you ask a very broad question. I don't know if I can get to a real definite answer for you, but we have some diversity and we try to deal with that. I think the local need has to be determined by the local board, and they provide the resources and we assist.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson, did you have a follow-up?
Just one real brief one. Is it ever possible for legislators to attend some of those meetings to actually see kind of what's going on?
Through the chair, Carl Rose, I believe you all are invited to the annual conference in the fall, and we do have academies, and in fact, we've even tried to bring some of that to this building and in services, and yes, you are welcome.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to bring up one thing on this page right here at the very bottom where it says obligation and opportunity. The second sentence there, the challenge is that all children do not have access to an equitable education experience. And we all know that's true because of the differences in the rural areas and the urban areas. It says additional designated funding will help school leaders meet that responsibility. Adding funds to the foundation formula and collaboration between individual legislators and school districts to expand digital learning opportunities for students can transform education in Alaska. For us to miss this opportunity to change the face of teaching and learning how would be a tragedy. And I think this is something that is very much needed because we can't get to the far reaches of some parts of the state with internet, at least enough that they can really have something streamed, you know. I think this is just a great opportunity, and it's something that I think we really need to look at, and we need to look at it as something that's sustainable. It's not going to do any good to just give it to one grade level and then hope that we're going to use those same iPads or smart boards or whatever as they move along. Only one group gets it. So I think it's important that we have something that is sustainable, something that the schools can say, okay, we know we're going to get this much money next year, and we are going to have to put money with it. Are we going to do this? And I think that as the Board of Education sees how their kids are learning and what's happened, that there will be such a awesome experience for them to see how their children are progressing, that they will want to do this. And I think it's up to us to make sure that, if at all possible, we can make this happen.
Thank you. Representative Feige, but before that, I'd just like to say, too, that I appreciate people recognizing my part of this, but the ones that really contributed was, where Caltech did not get its fish processing plant, Tok didn't get its biomass project finished, and Tan and our chiefs had lots of concerns about clinics and everything else. So they were the ones that really made the sacrifice. I just was the one willing to take the heat for piloting this, but they were really the ones that made the sacrifice. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there's, I'm sold on the advantages of digital learning. It certainly seems to produce results. I know when I have any questions, I go to my 11-year-old tech expert, who's increasingly frustrated with the lack of performance on her father's part. But two things about the bill. So essentially two questions. Your factor of 1.005% or 1.005, is that enough?
Through the chair, Carl Rose, we came up with the number as a number that we thought would be small enough where people could get their arms wrapped around it. To answer your question, no, I don't think it's enough. I think it could be larger. But we needed to start somewhere. If we get it in as part of the foundation form and as part of the block grant, as needs increase, we can try to increase the figure. But we just didn't want to go for something that would be rejected because it was too large.
Okay. Keep in mind that technology just does change and it requires an ongoing capital investment. Might need to do just a little bit more research, I guess, to see if 1.005 might be enough to sell it, but is it enough to really actually accomplish anything, or are we just kind of throwing buckets of water on a fire instead of using a fire hose? The second question is, obviously this is going to get wrapped in with the BSA and all the other general funding that goes to the districts. Is there any control in this this particular arrangement of policy that ensures that the money that we're trying to put into the digital learning system, is there any control in here that says that the districts will spend that money on digital learning? Or does it just get lumped in with the rest of the money going to classroom and facility costs?
Through the chair, Carl Rose. Representative Feige, last year we put vocational money in, and we asked that people report on how that money was going to be spent, and I think you should do the same thing with this. You should ask for some accountability on how the money was spent through the foundation.
Representative Seaton.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. The iTunes University, the Alaska Apps, are those available free to districts, or are those charged per device that that's added onto?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, Bob Wicker, CDL. iTunes U is all free content. It has to be free in order to be in iTunes U. And we're working with different partners around the state to help to fill that repository. There are other efforts in the state to do things like what we're doing also, and that's a good thing, in that this is too big of an issue for any one entity to take on by themselves. So I think that with these other entities that are working with this digital repository, we're finding we're coming up with a pretty solid base for teachers and students and leaders, school leaders, to find the content that they're needing.
Follow up?
Thank you, and it's a different question. Canby, Oregon, which I guess, we've had the presentations, you had them at your conference, was still purchasing about 2-to-1 iPod touches to iPads. I'm seeing here we're going all to expensive devices, iPads. When they were asked, why are you doing the iPod touches, utilize the same apps, smaller screen, that kind of thing, but also the carryability by the students. And frankly, they said, there's only so much money and you can buy twice as many devices with the iPod touches. Do we have, it sounds like Alaska is saying don't do iPod touches, do iPads. And do you have any information that iPads are more effective at increasing education than the iPod touches? Because I didn't see that Canby, Oregon had any information, and they were still looking for it, but has any been generated since that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, Bob Wicker. I think that what a bill like HB 242 does is it puts the selection of a device into the district's hands, and that while there's been much excitement around the iPad right now, and that's why we generated this project in HD6. There's going to be all kinds of devices that people use. iPod touches, iPads, laptops for some. Right now in the press, there's a number of stories out about different school districts who are making a lot of progress. One is Mooresville, North Carolina. They're they're saying the laptop is the tool for them. So I think different school districts are going to make their choices for their need. In Canby, I was involved with Canby in the early days of when they started that. It was all around money, and what could we do that has the capability for the learning objectives that we want? And it turned out to be an iPod Touch. If you go there now, they're making a big move into iPads also. But it's a very fluid environment. You know, the advantages, I don't think you're going to see any like hard numbers of science that tells you that an iPad is better than an iPod Touch, but it's going to be a decision of form factor. If you're using a technology device for, let's say, a child of special needs, sometimes that small screen is just not one that they can navigate. So it's going to be different things for different uses. And I think that's what HB 242 does, because there's all kinds of stuff in there, right? Whiteboards, iPod Touches, iPads, whatever is coming, and who knows what's going to come next month. So you never know.
Yeah, just a short follow-up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, what I'm hearing from the consortium is iPads, and I just want to make sure that as information, I mean, all the districts rely basically on the consortium to give them the basic foundation of where they should be going. Mm-hmm. And I'm just hopeful that the consortium is doing a comparison of technologies and the actual results of utilizing those technologies, so that we make sure that we're getting the biggest bang for the buck and getting the most growth and the most usability. Because I can just see that when you have a big expensive device, it's less likely to be checked out. It's less likely to be extended over the summer to those students, and so we have that drop off in education. And so I don't know that that's going to be a factor, but I just want to make sure that the consortium looks at comparing educational objectives and educational achievement, and we just don't focus on one thing. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I remember when I was in college, I took this tax class, and we all had computers, and they were the ones that were sunk in, had a glass plate on them. If I had stood up at any point in time, I probably would have seen about half the class doing stuff separate from tax. How are we making sure, Chris, we're talking about individual items here. What controls do we have to make sure that kids, and yes, we may be talking about second, third, fourth grade, but as my colleague here at the end mentioned, some of these kids are a lot better at accessing this stuff and figuring this stuff out before. Why is the move to an individual device that's in front of them, I don't know if it's the whole time, as opposed to setting aside certain periods of time where you have maybe a particular lab, and then we utilize technology such as the smart boards, which there has been a big push in many of the districts, including my own district, has been moving more to that. How do we control this individual item here that could potentially become a distraction, like cell phones and texting, and some of the teachers that I've talked to have had some concerns about kids not paying attention because they are finding other sources of to spend their other ways to spend their time.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, Bob Wicker. You know, I think with the iPad and what we've found with that is that you have different apps that are loaded on by the school. Many of those are standalone. One of the main strategies of that project was voice recording. So there was a voice recording on there, and then kids would read and then reread and reread the same book over and over and listen to them. So it really comes down to the instructional strategy that you're using. When you get to other apps that require online work, and that's where some of the distractions come, You have things that schools are doing now policy-wise to make sure that for one, the bad things don't get in and that you don't get into bad things. And so that comes down to filtering and that kind of thing. It all comes down to helping teachers understand how to teach with these tools also, because you can see that in an engaged classroom with people, with students who are doing engaging things. I would imagine your tax class, I don't know if you like taxes or not, but some of the people in that class were probably not too excited about it. I'm not sure. But
sure, Representative Pruitt was.
But there, you know, that's the challenge of our teachers now, and that's why professional development is so important, and why it's so good to have it within this bill also, in that it's pretty much in a previous life of mine that when we would go into a school and we would find distractions like that happening. It was usually that the teachers hadn't had much training and they didn't have much professional development, and they were trying to do the same old things with new tools. And that led to this boredom, really. So there is that danger, I guess. But I think that's something that... you know, the digital or the interactive whiteboards is like one to many, and when you get to that tool per learner, then there's some things. I mean, education is pretty good at thinking that they know how to do things. I mean, there are things that we don't. Their reading is a real mystery sometimes, and teaching kids to do some of these, we don't know what's going on in their brain. And sometimes there's a kid sitting there that can't hear very well, but we don't catch it for years. Okay, so those are the types of things that a tool per learner can sometimes help with, because they know what they need. So they go find out how to use that tool to quotes rectify that issue. So.
If I could speak to that as well, and then Representative Seaton on the subject. Before I came down here, I met with the folks from Dell. And they have a system that could also incorporate iPads or their own pad, and where a teacher could actually sit at his or her desk and be able to monitor what every student is looking at. And as iPads become more of a tablet, they could actually sit and be able to click on any student in the classroom and watch what they're doing. So you could sit here and tell if the student over there was multiplying 4 times 4 and got 18. So that is down the road. I do know that.
Just a quick follow-up.
Oh, please.
Then can I ask, related to the professional development that you were mentioning, is because I think there's obviously, there's some, you hear some discussion from teachers that some feel that they get really good professional development, others feel that they don't. And, of course, I can't judge that. Is there additional money set aside to help this? Is there? I mean, how are we going to ensure that? That's one of my concerns. That would be one of my concerns. Is how would we ensure that the teachers are ready to be able to teach this? And then what do you do? Of course, I come from a very large school district, and I've had teachers that flat out said, I've been teaching this way for 20 years. There's no way I'm going to use that smart board. We're talking about smart boards. Put an iPad in their hand, we may scare them. So, what are we doing to ensure that they're getting that development? And that it's integrated somehow in all the other development that they need to bring today's kids up appropriately.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, Bob Wicker. I think that through these projects that we've had over the years, the conversations have really changed, and it's not about necessarily hardware. I mean, people know that they need to get these new things that are coming out into the hands of teachers and students, but it really is about training. So training and professional development. I don't think there's a debate by any school administration that I know of within the state about the need for professional development. So in most instances, if there's not professional development coming forth, it's either a matter of money or it's a matter of time, which is really a matter of money, okay? Because time is money. So those things have, I mean, through this 8 years of CDL, people have kind of started to understand that this is not a separate standalone deal. Technology, and I would rather ban that word and just get it out of here, because we're really talking about teaching and learning in a modern age. So teachers who are in this age now need to know how to use those tools.
Thank you. Representative Seaton and Representative Wilson, and perhaps we should move on, because we could do this one for till 10. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess the question of, you know, outside applications and other things, my understanding from the conference was that that's pretty much hasn't been a problem, because every time it's synced with it, it's got to be synced with the school computers. Every time it's synced, if there's apps on there that were not authorized in, they show up, first of all, on the teacher's computer that somebody had these apps, and it also wipes them out. So just for the viewing public, it's something that's a lot more controllable than I had thought. I was worried about that, and then when we're talking about school districts that have implemented this, they found it wasn't a problem at all, because once somebody buys something and they lose it, and the teacher knows about it, it became a pretty much a non-issue. So is that what you're experiencing as well?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. I was actually on the plane last night coming down helping another representative, what I call blow up his iPad, so that, because he had some things on it that his son had put on that weren't, you know, shouldn't be there. So yes, that's exactly what happens. The management, and that's another thing with the tablets that are coming out, and with any new device that's going to be coming, the management of those things are going to be easier and easier to do. That's why that's another reason why we went with iPads, is that it's a teacher managed solution rather than a tech managed solution.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, then we do need to move on.
Okay, and I'm marking up the bill as we go along to so that when I come back the next time, it'll be a better bill. What I'd like you to do is go to the fiscal note, and the second page of the fiscal note, the very paragraph, you might say, it says this legislation will need to be updated to include new vocational education factor, or CTE, which passed in the 2011 legislative session and signed by the governor into law. My comments are, what are the wishes of the committee? Should I update that to include that, or leave this as a digital and not include that? I mean, I'd like some direction.
Representative Feige?
I would imagine the Finance Committee would eventually request it, so you might as well.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do I understand this to mean that putting this 1.005 in there eliminates what we passed last year as the 1%? I mean, and then that's why it needs to be updated?
It was, through the chair, there was only one, that was one-time money. So, do we keep this as one-time money? Wasn't that one-time money that we did last year?
I think someone, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I thought that money was, it's now 21% in the block grant.
Okay, so that's an onward?
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yes.
Okay, so we just need to make sure that it continues to be. Okay.
Thank you. If people don't mind, we will set this one aside. Certainly exciting. And we do want to thank everybody, Carl Rose and Bob, thank you for your testimony. That's on SB8. Yes, and okay, Tom, thank you for being here, sir. We have SB8, and if you would just identify yourself for the record and explain SB8 to us, if you would.
Thank you, Chairman Dick. Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. I'm sorry she could not be here today because this has been a very important bill to her for several sessions. The bill before you, Senate Bill 8, is a request, is an act relating to the questionnaires and surveys administered in public schools. I think the one sentence of the fiscal note explains what we're trying to do here. This bill would return the administration of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the YRBS, to passive parental consent from active parental consent. Before I get into my sponsor statement, I briefly wanted to bring to your attention a handout that I had submitted at the last minute the other day that it comes off of the department's website, and I'd like to explain for the record what the Alaska Youth Risk Behavior Survey is. This description of 2011 results states that the Youth Risk Behavior Survey is part of a national surveillance system developed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, to assist with assessing and addressing the health risk of youth. It is conducted in Alaska every other year by the Department of Education and Early Development and the Department of Health and Social Services in cooperation with public schools. In spring 2011, the department surveyed 1,327 students from 40 high schools that were scientifically selected to represent all public high schools, excluding boarding schools, alternative schools, correspondence and home study schools, and correctional schools in Alaska. These results are representative of Alaska's high school students in grades 9 through 12 in traditional public high schools. At the same time, and for the second time, 969 students from 16 alternative high schools defined as serving high-risk students in Alaska were surveyed to evaluate and address the health risk of this unique population. And you can look at each at the separate results for traditional and alternative high schools on the website, and some of the results I attached, but they're in very brief, in very small print, but they are remarkable results. In the sponsor statement, the purpose of SB 8 is to increase participation in the National Biennial Youth Risk Survey in order to meet the minimum 60% participation level required by the Centers for Disease Control for the results to be validated and published along with other states. There have been years when Alaska has not met minimum participation levels. Failure to obtain survey information adversely affects the ability of educators, planners, policymakers, and parents to understand and address the important health and social issues that affect students' happiness and success in the future. To help achieve this objective, SBA changes the parental consent requirement for the YRBS from active to passive, that is, from written or to implied consent if parents are given notice at least 2 weeks in advance of the survey by U.S. mail or home delivery, the opportunity to review the entire survey at the school or the district's website, and often I understand a form with a return envelope to deny permission in writing. Most parents who do not want their children to participate usually notify the school immediately at registration in the beginning of the school year or after notice and before the YRBS is given early in the spring semester. It is the attention of other parents SB 8 is most designed to reach. Failure of parents to return written consent forms in the past has often been found to be the result of lack of attention rather than refusal. Then too, since the biennial survey is only given to a representative number of the 53 Alaska school districts and only to a representative sampling of high school classes, many parents and students will never be involved in the survey. Students are not forced or required to participate. SBA specifically provides that students may independently decline to participate or to answer specific questions in this completely voluntary and anonymous survey. If they do participate, absolute privacy and anonymity are maintained by strict administrative procedures and the return of individual surveys in private and secure sealed envelopes to CDC. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey helps guide and evaluate important health and prevention programs in both the public and private sectors. Local, state, and federal officials, schools, state and federal agencies, public and private grant programs, and nonprofit health organizations rely on these surveys to educate, allocate resources, and compare trends concerning safe behaviors. These include injury prevention, tobacco prevention and control, obesity prevention, diabetes, heart disease, stroke prevention, safe and drug-free schools, substance abuse prevention, violence and suicide prevention, HIV and STD prevention, and connectedness to teachers, parents, and other adults. In short, SB 8 simply makes it easier to obtain information on youth risk behavior surveys without violating students' or parents' rights to privacy, nor diminishing the ability of parents to supervise their children. At the same time, SB 8 increases parental notice with ample opportunity, instructions, and forms to opt out. And I would bring to your attention that just before your committee, Senator Davis has also submitted SB 137, which relates to suicide awareness and prevention training for teachers and other school personnel. And in part, this was brought to your attention because of this particular survey, which you'll notice is still a very serious problem where there are attempts made each year and the numbers have not gone down a great deal. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Representative Seaton.
thank you. The sectional summary that we have on Section 3 says, add specific questions or processes for a student and parent to refuse to participate in a student survey by submitting a written denial of permission. And as I read the Section 3, it doesn't appear that a student has to provide a written denial of permission, that the student may, on line 14, may refuse to answer specific questions or participate in a questionnaire. So it appears that the parents can provide written denial, but the student at the time of the survey can refuse to answer specific questions or could refuse to participate on their own authority. And I just want to clarify that the wording in Section 3 of the bill is my interpretation and not the sectional that seems to indicate that the student would have to do a written denial.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's exactly the case. I read that myself and I thought it wasn't that clear, but the Section 3 is very clear as to answering specific questions, refusing student refusing either to answer the entire survey or to answer specific questions. And the written denial by the parent, of course, is overriding anything that would happen here. But this is a follow-up and a catch-all if students themselves, who for one reason or another, find themselves going into the survey and don't want to participate at any level.
Just follow. I just might suggest that section will be revised so that there is not confusion that and it's becomes obvious that the student can at the time refuse to participate or refuse to answer specific questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Tom, if you don't mind, I have a question. My question is who designed the questionnaire? And if people were to decide that this bill is the way we want to go, what says that those questions might not be changed down the road? An example might be, I don't see anything here referencing sexual preference. And so some of the feedback I've gotten would be, what chance could it be that these questions could be changed down the road? I think part of the reluctance was that by asking these questions, are we endorsing behavior? Are we inquiring about behavior? Or are we actually identifying behavior as risky behavior? So my question again is, who devised the questions and what's the possible changes if this bill were to pass?
Mr. Chairman, the survey itself is designed by the CDC, and it has to be given, those exact questions have to be given nationwide every 2 years, and that's the only way to validate the results. Now, it doesn't mean that any legislature or any person could not contact CDC with the explanation that they think that the questions should be changed, that society's changing, they need to ask these questions about sexual preference, or maybe they feel that the questions themselves are not framed in a way that they find particularly comfortable. But the CDC is the ultimate controller of this, and that's the reason that they're so very particular in our increasing participation results, so that every state can be involved in this. And so legislators, parents, people using this can look across the country at what risky behaviors youth are participating in. But as to endorsing behavior, basically I don't think, and it's been my observation, that giving the that by participating in the survey or answering particular questions, that students are necessarily endorsing one behavior or another, or that they're being induced to think about one behavior or another. They face these questions and problems every day in their student lives. Essentially, this is an ID, this is an identification bank of information that all people at all schools and parents and other people around the country can get a finger on what's going on. And I think if you look at the summary of the 2011 results that I provided, you'll realize that smoking is still an enormous problem. Drug use is amazing, and suicide is and a number in this state, of course, that outranks any other state. So you know, answering these things, I certainly understand your concern about that, but I do think that CDC is ultimately going to be the responsible for making any changes in the questions themselves.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question I have, I know that just like we as legislators want to be able to see what the schools are doing and be able to measure so that we can see if there's progress or not. There's different groups out that come into schools, like the American Heart Association, or a group that tries to slow down the smoking, and so the American Lung Association, whatnot. But that they're not even allowed to do that unless they can prove that what they're doing is effective. And without this survey to prove that they've been going into this school now, because they can use the results to say, yes, we see a decrease in smoking, so we know what the group that's coming in to try to slow down the smoking is working. But that those groups cannot even get their money from the federal government or wherever they're getting it unless they can prove that what they're doing is effective. Is that, correct in that or not?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think the survey material themselves that I just provided shows that they are actually tracking increases and declines in each particular area. And it's very interesting to note that in the area of smoking, it will probably be indicated it says it's at greater risk, comparing 2011 traditional and alternative students, that it says current smoking 14.1%. It means that students are still smoking, even despite all of the information regarding cancer and the other things that are going on, and it's a fairly high rate. And if you were to look at in the traditional schools, current smoking, it says in 1995 was 36.5% versus 2011, 14.1%. They say it's decreasing here, but it's still a very significant number. But the fact that they're comparing high and low gives each one of these agencies the ability to discuss what the importance of their activities are.
Representative Wilson.
And actually, the question that I was getting at was on that first page that shows the results between 1995 and 2011, is that that smoking has decreased. However, it hasn't decreased as much in the alternative schools, which shows that those students are at a greater risk for smoking than a regular student. So, but my question was, this is what those groups that come in and get funding so that the schools don't have to spend their money on it, they need this assessment so that they can prove what they're doing is helping. Am I correct or not on that point?
That's absolutely correct, through the chair, Representative Wilson, and you will have noticed that in the comparison of traditional and alternative schools, the alternative schools are higher across the board. I mean, it's just amazing. Sometimes they're more than twice as high.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tom, help me understand. I guess my question is, how could Alaska benefit from this? If all we're doing is giving CDC better data, I don't see how that really benefits us. But my understanding was that in order for some of the nonprofits to obtain funding in Alaska, that there was actually like a $70,000 pizza gathering just trying to get enough parents together so they could get enough parent participation so they could we could meet the 60% and therefore the nonprofits could get funding. My question then is, what are those nonprofit groups? I've had constituents come to me and say, what good are they would like to know whether those nonprofits are ones that they would actually support.
Well, through the chair, there's, a long list of the nonprofits that have supported us, including some of the backup material that I provided. And this has often been brought back to a money issue that's being pushed theoretically by the nonprofits out there, but it really isn't. It's an informational issue that our schools need to know in dealing with these high-risk behaviors. And you'll note that it is a zero fiscal note, and you're absolutely correct. It was $90,000 that schools provided, probably through pizza parties. This was all private funding, et cetera, to try to get more participation, more knowledge of this survey, to get parents to sign up for this thing if they fail to do so at the beginning of the school year. But I don't believe that this CDC process is at all driven primarily just by nonprofits that are looking out to bring money in. The only way we can deal with the students' high-risk behaviors throughout the country is to know what they're doing. And this is probably the very best way that we've been able to come up with, I think.
Okay, Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. To me, I think what I remember in all the different committee work, the finance subcommittees, that kind of thing, is that when you look at how the state is spending their money, what rankings we have relative to the rest of the country, which is kind of the benchmark that that in the finance subcommittee forums you see that mentioned. But this actually addresses exactly that even in our own state government, if we don't have a way of comparing ourselves with others, then it's just some game we're playing. It's not, it's more like some game of chance rather than something that's really focusing on public money, spending it right. And I also, in all of the reading I've done on health issues, believe that the philanthropic organizations across actually the world and the huge amount of money that comes to Alaska from those, we don't hear about them in this building, but boy, you do when you do investigate the different organizations in the state that are working on these issues, you do know that there's huge amounts of money come to the state, and it's based on knowing by something like these surveys that you actually have proof that there is a need. If there is no need, why would you spend the money? And why should we?
And through the chair, in response to Representative Sisna, you'll notice if you go into the survey results themselves, they run hundreds of pages with all the detail from all the states. So we do have the opportunity to review what other states are doing. This is just a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in Alaska. But it is a nationwide survey, has tremendous it benefits to our state to see what other states are doing.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked, what does it help, is it helping Alaska? And I think we can just look at this and see that there in what is happening in the schools, it says, did not go to school because they felt unsafe at school or on their way to or from school. There's been no change in that. Attempted suicide one or more times during the past year. There's been no change. There's been no decrease in that, which means even us as legislators, maybe we need to look at that and say, you know, maybe we need to put a little more money into something like this. So not only is it, I mean, it gives us information that we can look at and say, golly, we know that we're the highest in the nation, and yet what's been happening hasn't made a change in the percentage. So I think some of this information gives us information also when we start to think about where we should put money and if we should try something different.
We do have Ward Hurlbut, Director of Division of Public Health, online if we have any questions. And we do have people here to testify. Tom, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, Mr. Chair. I think I'll be available for any questions afterward if you need it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. But if we could, we do have people in the room to testify. Excuse me. Emily Ninon, are you here? Emily.
Yes, thank you.
And identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chairman Dick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Ninon. I am the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And to get to the point, picking right up where Mr. Obermeyer left off with the questions, why would the American Cancer Society care about this issue? I want to assure you that as odd as this may sound, I want to let you know, we're not doing anything in the schools. But we're encouraging the state health department to do things in the schools, and that's where you all come in as legislators. We care about this issue because the information gathered in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey is used to measure the effectiveness of all of the programs that we support. We in public health and you as legislators need this information in order to know that the state's investments are working, and also to know what emerging issues need to be addressed. This has already come up. We have seen in the last decade a 50% decrease in youth smoking in this state. Are we done yet? No. But we've made tremendous progress, and we're able to measure that through a survey tool such as this. The problem that this bill addresses really doesn't have anything to do with the survey tool itself, but rather one of logistics. Current law ties the hands of school districts from being able to implement the survey in a manner that works best for their district. Now, some people have, over the years that I've been following this issue, have referred back saying, you know, this would take us back to where we were before the law was changed in 1999. It doesn't, actually. I've gone back and compared those statutes. And somewhere in your stack of bill packet on this, there should be, I actually just put it into a Word document. Back in pre-1999, there were four very vague lines about how surveys should be done in schools. The 1999 law very appropriately put in a lot more protections for parents, students, information. All those things are actually maintained in this bill, and even some of even added to some of the information that gets to parents, increased in this bill. So we're keeping and expanding on those protections, but just making the logistical hurdle a little easier for school districts to be able to implement this, reducing that administrative burden while balancing that with the need for parents to have engagement in what's going on with their kids. So this bill, we support it because it supports both that parental engagement and the ability to better serve our youth and monitor what's going on with our state resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from committee? Thank you, Emily. It's good. We have other people lined up here, and I understand Ward Hurlbut, I understand you do want to testify. Ward, are you online?
Yes, sir, Chairman Dick. Thank you very much. I had called in to testify. I appreciate that.
Go ahead with your testimony.
For the record, I'm Ward Hurlbut. I'm the Director of Division of Public Health and Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Health and Social Services. I would certainly corroborate the things that Mr. Obermeyer said, that the survey is very important to schools, school districts, Department of Education, Early Development, Health and Social Services, CDC, and it is important to us receiving grants there. Our experience generally is about 10% of parents decline, but about one out of five parents just don't return the survey. And that's after multiple tries, sometimes including pizza parties, to get the parents involved. And so the challenge is to get enough parents to comply and to approve having the survey done. It does require 60% for statistical significance, as Mr. Obermeyer mentioned. The governor's office certainly appreciates the importance of the survey and the value to us in having this done. I would expand a little bit on Mr. Obermeyer's comments. About 25 out of the 106 questions in the survey are questions that are submitted by the state of Alaska. And we have submitted questions related to academic performance, exposure to secondhand smoke, source of alcohol when they get it, a number of areas like that. But the bulk of the questions are determined by CDC. They can be changed over the year. Chairman Dick, you asked about the questions themselves. Some of the questions, I believe, are put in the context of a presumption that young people do engage in behavior that many young people do not. And the reason for that context is to make it comfortable to respond with honest answers. There's no disagreement with the importance and the value of the survey to us. The governor does not support having the passive type of permission. He has been committed to this concept since he was in the legislature and was engaged in adopting the current law. The governor obviously is very, very committed to strengthening Alaska's families through the engagement of parents with their children. And so this is the reason that that he does not support the bill, because he believes that having the active consent of the parents helps to facilitate the engagement of parents with their children. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions, Chairman Dick.
Question from committee. Representative Sisto and Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, and I certainly understand that we do have our own strong feelings, but I think that there's a fair amount of evidence that was even mentioned in the testimony that we just heard, that there's literally not much actual response from, at least percentage-wise, from parents. And actually, that's maybe a question of the sponsor's representative. But it does sound as if parents are more responsive at the very beginning, and to be constantly trying to get responses from parents on each of these kinds of questionnaires is slowing down and actually pulling us away from having the kind of critical look that we do need to have. Our state leads the nation in so many very, very critical behavioral health situations. And I think it really is imperative that we take action against what puts our state in the position of having very, very poor comparative position, not only just to get money, but in knowing exactly what our problems are and how to focus on them.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Overmeyer from Senator Davis, if I could respond to that. I think Carol Como's on the line. At least she said she would call in, even though the school districts are off today. And I think she could address what's going on in the largest school district in Alaska. I had hoped that maybe the people that do the surveys in the school district and maybe the person that handles it for the state might be here to explain how we gather the information. The parents are asked at the beginning and the very part of registration to look at this form that's probably out with a number of other papers. Then they, in spring, try to get more active engagement. They have pizza parties. But to know exactly how it's pulled together, I think, is important. And I would ask that experts in that area address that. Thank you.
I believe Representative Kawasaki has a question of Ward Hurlburt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Ward, for being online. So just purely from the public health perspective, representing an agency that has to deal with numbers and try and find out what's going on with our youth, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the value of the data that comes from it.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the data that comes from the survey is quite valuable to us. It gets at many of the issues of youth behavior that can present risks to the youth, present risk later in life. And so the data is valuable to us as a public health agency. From my colleagues in the education side, clearly it's of high value to them. So there's no doubt and no disagreement in the governor's office or in the public health division that the data is valuable to us.
Follow up?
I don't want to put you cross with the governor, but I guess if this committee and the House Education Committee were to come up with a better solution to make sure that we get to the 60% of the families, is it that the governor wants to spend more money on pizza parties to get those folks to sign those letters? Or I mean, what's the best way, right? What's the best way to get sort of compliance so that we can get these numbers, which are of obvious value to your agency?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the history was that the completion rates were greater before the present law went into effect about a dozen or 13 years ago. It was easier with a passive type acceptance. However, in my mind, there is absolutely no doubt that the governor is motivated by wanting to strengthen families in our state, sees that as a critical issue for all of us, and I'm comfortable that's the reason that he prefers the current methodology.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
A pass.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'm a little confused. So if we don't get the 60%, so that the data is not scientifically defensible, does the Department of Health go ahead and use the data even though it doesn't meet the scientifically defensible or reliable level, and just proceed with using it anyway? Or do you do you just not use it for those years in which we don't reach 60%?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this last year in 2011, we achieved not quite 63%. 2 years previously, we were slightly lower than that. But as you have in the material, I believe that you have, there have been years when we have not been able to achieve the 60%. The information is informative in those years, but it cannot be as conclusively used when you reach statistical significance. And likewise, it is a handicap to us in obtaining grants for some of the important programs that we believe can benefit Alaska's youth.
Okay, thank you. We only have 6 minutes left, and we have two people that would like to testify. If we could at least get Ryan Kaufman, and then I promise excuse me, Representative Sissonner, did you have something specific for Ward Hurlbut?
I was wanting to actually go, and it's wonderful hearing from Department of Health and Social Services, but I think this issue about what's happening with the school districts themselves and having having Anchorage's school district spoken to is something that we do need to have. If that's possible after the one you're thinking of, but I think it is important for us to get to this because there's something really critical going on here.
Carol Como was online, but she dropped off. She dropped off. But I would like to, we have 5 minutes left. Ryan Kaufman from Sitka, are you there? Are you online?
I'm here. Yep.
Ryan, if you'd identify yourself for the record and give your testimony, please.
Ryan Kaufman, resident of Sitka, representing myself on my own time. I'd like to thank the House Education Committee for your time and energy. I think that we're all here because we support youth and we want to reduce their risk behaviors in order to increase their success. So I thank you for that. I provide this testimony with all respect for the privacy of students and their parents. And with that said, I'd like to remind the committee that this survey is completely anonymous and confidential. And I think that many of the key points have been hit today by Tom as well as Emily, and that this is an evaluation tool that allows us to provide services that are relevant and consistent with the risk behaviors that are experienced by Alaskan students. Representative Dick had a question of how does this benefit Alaska, and I would like to say that the benefit to Alaska is that we live in a state with high risk behaviors for our adult population. By addressing risk behaviors at a younger age, we will in turn ultimately have a lower number of risk behaviors in our adult population, which will reduce fiscal costs and also increase quality of life for Alaskan residents. On that fiscal note, I noticed that there is no fiscal note attached to this, and I would argue that if there would be a fiscal benefit to passing SBA, and that is that through the prevention programs, there's an increasing number of prevention programs that are provided through school districts with public dollars, both federal and state. And I would argue by collecting information that ensures that these programs are effective and hitting the mark will be a more effective use of those funds. Currently, we're in a system, we're unable to collect the data that we need to address these risk behaviors. We're ultimately just we're guessing and we're basing it on anecdotal evidence, so we are quite possibly missing the mark. In my role through the Sitka School District of coordinating this survey, it's been my experience that the effort required to collect the minimum, and last year we had a 66% participation rate in the survey. The effort to collect that percentage of students' active parental consent is extraordinary. It's multiple mailings home. It's sending permission forms home with students. It's follow-ups by going door-to-door and knocking on doors. Fortunately, we live in a community that's small geographically, so that's possible. And then following up, going to parents' workplaces. It's incredible the amount of effort. And I think the point was made before that about 10% declined, so we're currently operating under a system that accommodates for that 10%, and usually that 10% are vocal in not wanting their students to participate, and I absolutely respect that and value that. Again, I'd like to thank the committee for their time and encourage them to support SBA. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll field any questions as well.
Any questions from committee? We are short on, do you have a question of
if I can address it to both of them.
Okay. Representative Feige, I believe Representative Feige has a question about Ward Hurlburt as well as Ryan. So go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And gentlemen, you don't need to respond immediately, but if you could get back to the committee, perhaps with an answer to the question. If I understand it correctly, you're looking to say that to be scientifically valid, you need to sample 60% of the total student population. To me, that seems a bit high. We typically sample much lower percentages of a total population to get a statistically valid result. So my question is, what standard deviation are you setting as the bar for scientifically valid, and what sample size do you need to accomplish that? Thanks.
Okay, we are running out of time. Carl Rose, you're always with us, sir. So he was the only other one signed up to testify. We do need to respect your need to be in other places. So we won't close testimony, but we will put this aside. On Wednesday, February 22, 8 a.m. sharp, we will have a presentation by Phil Knight, Superintendent of Volusia's East Borough School District, one that we haven't heard from. We all need to get familiar with that. And we will also deal with the CS for HB 256, and we will be intervening with intervention. So it should be a good morning on Wednesday. So no further business. We are adjourned.